Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are always privileged to be able to tap the intelligence, in every sense of the word, of our first guest. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He is a former member of the United States Army, served with distinction in uniform, and then took it off to go undercover to serve in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, operating, among other places, in the Afghan theater, not in Afghanistan itself, but in interesting areas nearby. He also served as the leader of our foray into Iraq in the effort to liberate that country from Saddam Hussein. He has gone on to many other things, serving as an assistant attorney general out in Washington State, as a candidate for Congress, as an author of terrific books, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency, and not least, as the driving force behind a terrific online resource and magazine.com. Sam Faddis, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir. Sam, we're going to spend much of the day talking in this program about, as I think the country is more generally, what on earth has happened in and to Afghanistan in the space of, it seems like, the blink of an eye, as a result, obviously, of decisions made by Joe Biden, and he would argue by President Trump as well. Give us your sense of both what's taken place, and let's then talk about the implications.
Well, I think it is very hard to exaggerate the scope of the debacle. It is grotesque. Nothing is being managed properly. Nothing was planned for properly. It is as bad as it looks on your television screen, and a whole heck of a lot worse. I mean, just as an example, a piece. Everybody's focused on folks flying out of Kabul Airport. Well, we don't have all the Americans out of Afghanistan right now. And a number of them at this stage are effectively behind Taliban lines, and we have no mechanism to get them out. And I'm not even sure, as far as I can tell from talking to all my contacts, not even a really good appraisal of how many of those folks there are. And then, of course, there are the geopolitical implications, which we will feel for years all over the world in terms of jihad all over the Middle East. And God knows the Chinese have to be looking at places like Taiwan and thinking, well, we didn't think Joe would fight for this place before, and we sure as heck don't think he will now. So we will pay for this for a really long time.
In my commentary today, Sam, I talked about something that's not an insight unique to me by any means, but the parallels between what is happening at the moment and what happened in the 1970s, in a period when in two different parts of the world we saw, well, to put a fine point on it, democratic policies with which Joe Biden was associated or at least supportive. In the first instance, cutting off the funding that was essential to enabling the Republic of South Vietnam to defend itself. And in the second instance, to undermine the Shah of Iran that resulted in the return of the Ayatollah Khomeini and everything that has flowed from that horrific strategic misstep. In both instances, Sam, as you know, there were the sorts of long-term, profound implications, both for the people most immediately involved, of course, but also for us, for our interests, for our reputation, for our leadership around the world. do we anticipate, or should we, I guess I should say, anticipate that there will be similar long-term implications and truly global ones at that?
Without question, that is precisely what we are looking at, and the ripple effects of this will be felt for decades to come. We are still, as you pointed out, Iran, just to grab one piece of that, okay, we are wrestling with the implications of Jimmy Carter walking away from the Shah to this day. We still have not turned the corner on that threat. We are wrestling with an Iran that is on the verge of becoming a nuclear power. We will be dealing with those kinds of issues at this. This is not a matter of the headlines will go away and the horrible footage will go away and then we can forget about Afghanistan. That is not what is going to happen here. We are going to see the impact all over the world, and we're probably going to see it almost immediately in emboldened Al-Qaeda, emboldened ISIS, and as I suggested, adversaries that don't really directly relate to them but are going to look at this and say, like the Chinese, and say, okay, well, clearly you are not a threat. You are not serious. We do not have to be concerned about you pushing back. We will move. We will move right now.
I want to come back to Taiwan. We're going to talk about it with our subsequent guests, Gordon Chang and Bill Walton as well. But before we do, there is a narrative that is being pushed, I think, by the Biden administration and or its friends and allies in Congress and the media, that this was really an intelligence failure to have misunderstood how fast things would unravel in Afghanistan and how completely. You've served in the intelligence community for decades. You've written the book about the decline and fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you describe what's going on now as a failure of intelligence?
Well, I mean, I hate to use a phrase that I heard Mr. Clapper use yesterday, because I hate to echo anything that gentleman says, but he described this at one point as a whole of government failure, and that's the way I would look at it. Is it an intelligence failure? Yes. I suspect we don't have the quality of intelligence, even begin to have the quality of intelligence we need on the ground in Afghanistan. But it's a failure at every other level. I mean, I don't, some of the details of what I'm hearing from my contacts, quite frankly, I don't want to go into because I think it would be helpful to the enemy. But the scope of the catastrophe, the extent to which we were completely unprepared to deal with this is mind-boggling. The speed with which people are having to move troops and aircraft and munitions from the far side of the earth to mount a frantic rescue effort is just, when you and I both know the scope of the Department of Defense, and the idea that that machine could be caught so completely off guard is just terrifying, really. I mean, we are jumping through the hoop trying to make this happen.
Let me play the devil's advocate here, Sam. It seems to me that what is a failure of intelligence, if one wishes to use that expression, is the basic intelligence or common sense, if you will, that seems to be in such short supply at the moment when you fail to appreciate what the impact of selling people out is on morale and the willingness to fight and the willingness to, you know, stand your ground and hold on to all of this fancy equipment that the United States gave you rather than, you know, turn it over to the enemy and run for your life or try to cut the best deal you can. I mean, that's a quality of intelligence, I guess one might say, but it's not seemingly at the level of, you know, an institutional failure as much as it's a failure of policy and judgment and just sheer incompetence with respect to the nature of war. No?
Yeah. I don't disagree with anything you said, Frank. I mean, the Biden administration terrifies me because of its ideological bent in many respects. I mean, the most radical regime we've ever had. But on any given day, what terrifies me maybe even more on any given day is the grotesque incompetence. They are not only radicals and have this crazy agenda on so many levels, but their execution is horrifyingly bad. They have opened the border in Mexico and let everybody flood in, and yet they're talking to the Border Patrol behind closed doors saying, obviously this can't go on. We've got to figure out how to deal with this. Well, you would have thought through that before you made the first decision to open the border. Where does this go? You have now executed Afghanistan so terrifyingly badly that we will be threatened as a nation here on U.S. soil as a consequence for decades to come. It is stupefying.
A little Socratic dialogue here with you. It seems to me that incompetence can explain some of the missteps, some of the hash-ups, some of the failures. But I don't think it can explain all of them. And as a result, I've defaulted to this idea, Sam Faddis, that this is really a deliberate policy, a wrecking operation against the United States of America on the home front, on domestic policy, and with respect to its foreign and national security policies. It's so comprehensive, I don't think any other explanation suffices. I mean, are they contributing factors? Yes, no question about it. But partly, and you've done as much as anybody, Sam, at End Magazine and at the accountabilityinitiative.org, to document the people who are making these policy choices. They're generally not stupid people, but they are compromised people. They are radical people in many cases. They are perhaps even Marxist in character and revolutionary in purpose. And when you put all that together, this is not an accident, comrade, what is happening to us, nor is it something you can attribute just to, you know, malfeasance.
Well, I can't disagree with any of that. I mean, we have what I call, you know, I refer to this administration as the Manchurian administration, right? It is composed of, if Xi Jinping picked this cabinet, and this president, this would have been his A team. They are not inclined to stand up for the United States. They believe we are a declining power. That's before we get to overtly Marxist thought, critical race theory, all of that, that we are an inherently evil nation, and we are the ones who've been causing all the trouble in the world for centuries. So all of that is manifestly true.
So Sam, you've spent much of the past couple of, as I say, decades working against what I think they call themselves the global Islamic movement, the jihadist enterprise that the Islamic doctrine of Sharia commands faithful Muslims to engage in. And you've talked a bit about Al-Qaeda being emboldened and the Islamic State being emboldened. The Muslim Brotherhood, obviously, has to be extremely heartened by all of this as well. When you look at the various places around the world where these guys are now operating or can, you mentioned our border, increase their numbers inside our own country, how seriously do you think we should take the problem that we're going to be facing a new and resurgent and more dangerous jihadist component here at home, not just in other parts of the world that we care about?
Well, that again is guaranteed, right? We just poured jet fuel onto this fire of Islamic jihad, and we're going to feel it everywhere. And we have abandoned control of our borders, so anything on earth could walk across that border, a number of individuals, and a number of types of weapons. When we went into Afghanistan after 9/11, amongst other things, Al-Qaeda, because they had that entire safe haven, had a very robust chemical weapons program. Osama bin Laden was in direct contact with a bunch of Pakistani nuclear scientists in a group called UTN about building an atomic bomb. I mean, we could go on down this list for a long time, but they... 9/11 was not the end of anything. It was the beginning of attacks, and the attacks that were to follow on would have made it pale in comparison. Well, we just went right back there, except now actually the Taliban is stronger and much better equipped. So that's right where we went.
And one of the other things, Sam, and I know you used to spend time finishing up at the CIA in the weapons of mass destruction terrorism portfolio, which I think you directed in your last assignment at CIA. Certainly, the Al-Qaeda and Islamic State and other jihadist elements, the Taliban for that matter, have to have taken away from what has happened to the world, and notably the United States, as a result of this biological weapons attack against us, and I use that term advisedly, by the Chinese Communist Party, that's a bet they don't want to miss as well, don't you think?
Without question. I think you and I have discussed this. However this pandemic originated, I don't think there's any question it came out of a Chinese lab, whether we want to say it was deliberate or whether it's just, sloppiness.
We may not ever know that, but when you've got biological weapons being unleashed against us, it constitutes an attack as far as I'm concerned, especially when they did nothing to stop it.
100%. And it is also a template. You have now seen exactly how this works and what can be done with a sufficiently communicable disease. And you have seen the incompetence, quite frankly, of our response. So everybody who wishes us ill on the planet, state actors, terrorist actors, has taken note of that. They now have the playbook. This is how you do it, folks. And now we have granted them the nation of Afghanistan, it's not a nation. We have granted them Afghanistan once again as a safe haven in which where they can do whatever they want, build whatever program they want, and then launch from there against the rest of the world. We're right back to there.
This has to be enormously painful for veterans like yourself, of whether the conventional forms of warfare or unconventional ones, Sam Faddis, and I think it is, as you say, sadly, the case that many of us will have an opportunity to rue the day that Joe Biden brought this upon us in the fashion that he has, and we will find ourselves, I think, paying the consequences for some time in this theater and far beyond, as you've warned, and God help us is all I can say. We need divine intervention to stave off some of what is likely to flow from it. Sam Faddis, on that unhappy note, I have to say goodbye to you, but thank you for your time today and for your tremendous service to our country, Sam, including not least what you're doing these days at AndMagazine.com. It's so appreciated, as are your visits to us. We'll look forward to doing it again next week. God bless you in the meantime. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll take stock with him on what all this means for China and Taiwan and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden has repeatedly boasted that America is back. It turns out we're back to the 1970s when, thanks to ill-advised democratic policies he supported, we abandoned allies in Vietnam and Iran. What some are calling a failure of intelligence that has resulted in a cascading and ongoing series of disasters in Afghanistan is really a product of further unintelligent, yea, inane policy decisions by Biden and whoever is actually running the wrecking operation that passes for his administration. Millions of people in Afghanistan, and especially women and girls, will bear the immediate costs of the current absence of competent U.S. leadership, but make no mistake, ultimately, so will we here at home. To cite but one example, we have handed Sharia supremacists a decisive victory that will embolden them and our other enemies. Expect more jihadism and aggression worldwide and aimed at us. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure always to say we're back with Gordon Chang. He is one of our duty experts here, and for that matter, one of the country's duty experts on all matters involving Asia, but particularly what the Chinese Communist Party is doing there and from there to and for the rest of us. What I am particularly anxious to talk with Gordon about is something that he's given a lot of thought to over the years, which is America's role in the world and how what the Chinese are up to will be impacted by it. This brings us to the subject of his books and his writings at the Gatestone Institute and at Newsweek, among his books, The Coming Collapse of China. You can also follow him, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. So there's a lot to talk with him about at this moment, especially as a major development is taking place in Central Asia, namely the fall of the government of Afghanistan and the rise, once again, of the Taliban. Gordon Chang, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to have you with us, sir. I'm interested, Gordon, if you would indulge me for a moment in a bit of retrospective. You remember, I know, and have studied closely, the effects of America's abandoning its allies in South Vietnam in 1975. Do you anticipate similar kinds of repercussions, not just for the people most immediately involved, in this case, of course, the Afghans, but for us as well?
There very well could be a catastrophic effect from the fall of Afghanistan. There's a couple of things going on here, and one of them is President Biden's leadership. If he is able to bounce back, then we'll get through this relatively easily. But the problem here is that Beijing has been mocking the United States, and there's a sense that deterrence is failing. We heard that, of course, when China's top two diplomats went to Anchorage in the middle of March and confronted Secretary of State Blinken and National Security Advisor Sullivan, where the Chinese specifically said that the U.S. could no longer talk to China from a position of strength. This failure to engage and to implement an orderly withdrawal from Afghanistan, I think, is feeding into that narrative that the U.S. is no longer able to stand up to China. And that has deterrent effects all throughout the region and, of course, the world as well.
Yeah, I want to come back to that point. But before we do, let's talk a little bit about how China is likely to interact with and perhaps wind up sponsoring, supporting the Taliban in this post-U.S. moment. How do you see the relationship? What is China's ambition in Afghanistan at the moment? Obviously, mineral exploitation is something they've been doing there for some time. But how does the Belt and Road Initiative project bear on this relationship and where it goes from here, Gordon?
Well, China has talked about building a road between Kabul and Peshawar in Pakistan, and that's part of the Belt and Road program. I don't know if that ever will occur, Frank. The Chinese are still being stung in Pakistan. In July, there was that terrorist incident that killed 9 Chinese workers. And I think that's a real indication that even in a place like Pakistan, China is at risk. And certainly that would be true in Afghanistan as well. When we look at the general relationship between China and the Taliban, the important thing to note is that the Chinese embassy in Kabul is still open, as is the Russian one. And I think that's a result of that discussion in Tianjin at the last days of July between Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, and senior leaders from the Taliban. We don't really know what was said there, but it's an indication that the relationship between Beijing and the Taliban is going to be a fairly strong one going forward. So at least we can see the beginnings of the outlines of what China's doing. China, I think, doesn't want to get too much involved in Afghanistan, but nonetheless, they have got security interests there, and they will be focused on Afghanistan. And for us, that's a good thing because it means less focus on areas like Japan, Taiwan, India, and other hotspots.
It's an interesting proposition, Gordon. Let me just ask you, the Chinese have, of course, engaged in not only the horrific repression of millions of Muslim Uyghurs in Western China, the area they call Xinjiang, the locals call East Turkestan historically. There's a lot of what would think is Islamophobia taking place in communist China. If there is such a thing as Islamophobia, this would certainly be evidence of it. How is all of that likely to affect, if at all, the relationship between Beijing and the new government in Kabul, the Taliban?
I think the Taliban is willing to ignore a lot of what Beijing is doing, because Beijing is committing genocide, crimes against humanity, against Muslims, not only the Uyghurs, but the Kazakhs and other Turkic minorities. But we have seen throughout the Middle East and through Muslim-majority nations that they have really not raised the issue. Turkey did last decade, 2008, 2009. But then right now, Turkey is very much a supporter of Beijing and even extradites Uyghurs to China. So Beijing has been able to tame the Muslim world. And I'm sure that's going to be the same with the Taliban as well.
It's an interesting turn of phrase that the Turks are supporters of China. It sounds to me as though the Chinese are supporters of Turkey and therefore, you know, they've got them basically in the palm of their hand, as they do seem to have many others around the region. It's been said of the Taliban that they may be less susceptible to the bribes or the coercive pressure, that their commitment to Sharia supremacism is such, Gordon Chang, that they will, you know, exhibit solidarity with these oppressed Muslims rather than conform to the general practice of others, vis-a-vis the Chinese. Any thoughts on whether that may be so?
We certainly all like to see that, that the Uyghurs certainly need support from any element that they can get. But we also have to remember that China had a strong relationship with the Taliban, both before and after 9/11. And it's certainly not to the credit of someone named George W. Bush that he ignored China's relationship with the harborers of al-Qaeda, because he sought Beijing's help on, quote-unquote, the war on terrorism. I think that the Taliban is not going to help the Uyghurs, just largely because, based on past history and because on Beijing's probably substantial financial support for the Taliban.
Especially when they hear Tony Blinken and others suggesting that the international community will not be generous with foreign aid to the Taliban if they behave badly, which is absolutely a certainty. But the Chinese are in a position, apparently, to help offset any such punitive steps by the West, I take it. Gordon, let me turn to the topic that you raised a moment ago, because this question about the sufficiency of our deterrent at the moment is becoming even more problematic in light of what now appears to be a nuclear breakout by the Chinese. We've talked about this last week, I think, the silos that seem to be springing up like mushrooms after the rain in various deserts around China for presumably the purpose of deploying large numbers of heavily MIRVed intercontinental range ballistic missiles. Those would be missiles with multiple warheads, maybe as many as 10 apiece. If deterrence isn't on shaky grounds at the moment, let alone what will be the cumulative effect of all of these further threats from the Chinese as they materialize, are you now more concerned, especially when the world sees the unreliability of the United States vis-a-vis its allies, that Taiwan may be even more in China's crosshairs, more imminently perhaps at risk of military action against it than it has been even in recent months, when it has seemed to be increasingly the case that that's a distinct possibility?
The concern here is a general one. It's not Taiwan specific. It's just how does China view the Biden administration? And the question is really going to be answered on what Biden does going forward. If there's a real possibility that Biden will now be forced into doing things he didn't want to do because of the complete failure in Afghanistan, or he could just it could be the end of the Biden administration for a practical matter. And I don't know how the president is going to deal with this. What was really interesting to me, Frank, was that today there are no scheduled public events for Biden. And you would expect that there would be an address to the American people about this. And this will be an important signal on resolve. But as it stands right now, the Chinese, believe that they can, even more than they did a couple of days ago, believe that they can do what they want, wherever they want. And that, of course, puts Taiwan in the crosshairs.
No, but you're so right. It's not confined to Taiwan. Unfortunately, there will be more aggressiveness, I suspect, all over the world. And again, going back to what we touched on there a moment ago, this Belt and Road Initiative, Gordon, we haven't really talked about this at any length, I don't think, with you, but the Committee on the Present Danger, China, released a study a few weeks back about what we call China's dream, the world's nightmare, in which we profile, I think, 17 countries that are in the process, we believe, becoming captive nations, akin to, you know, East Turkestan and Southern Mongolia and Tibet and now Hong Kong, other captive nations, if you will, already under the Chinese thumb, or jackboot, as the case may be. The concern is that as you look at the infrastructure that's being built out worldwide, much of it inherently dual use, that is to say, capable of supporting the People's Liberation Army, if not at the moment, then certainly in the future. This potential for increased aggressiveness on the part of the Chinese, literally all over the world, 140 countries out of some 195 have become in one way or another, to some extent or another, implicated in the Belt and Road Initiative. It raises the prospect of a very, very dangerous strategic environment for the United States, the free world more generally, no?
Well, it certainly does. But on the other side of the ledger, there is imperial overstretch. And China's Belt and Road program has run into a number of roadblocks, largely because China doesn't have the funds to accomplish its ambitions. But there are certain Belt and Road projects that pose an immediate threat to the U.S., including those in two of them in the Bahamas, and one of them less than 100 miles away from the Florida shore. So there are these projects that we have to be very careful about. But in general, I think what the United States needs to do is to make sure that China doesn't have the funds for these projects. And one of them is cutting down or eliminating commerce, eliminating investments, and all the rest of it, so that China doesn't have the resources to achieve these grand ambitions. But as you point out, Frank, if China does have these resources, it means that global Chinese ambition and domination.
We're going to talk more about the effort to constrain access to capital that you speak of there, Gordon, with Bill Walton in our next segment. But before we let you go, let me just ask you quickly. There was an important piece that appeared in the Epoc Times, terrific newspaper, on the 11th of August, under the headline, "Experts Warn Chinese Regime's Space Program is a, quote, direct military threat, unquote, to the United States." Now, Gordon, I know this is not news to you, but it is happening on a scale and in so comprehensive a way that it, again, I think can only reinforce the concern our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and you and an increasing number of Americans, I think, are experiencing about where this is all going to lead, especially if the Chinese have been emboldened by the pathetic performance of the Biden team. Talk quickly, if you would, Gordon, about how serious a threat you see this inherently, again, dual-use project in space.
Well, China's space program is run by the military. And in addition, of course, China has the doctrine of civil-military fusion, which means that the military has access to everything, even if it's nominally civilian. And where this is leading, Frank, which is what you talked about, Chinese officials since at least 2018 have been talking about the moon and Mars as sovereign Chinese territory. And they will exclude other nations from going to those heavenly bodies if they develop the capability to do so. So this is, many dictators have had the ambition of ruling the world, as does Xi Jinping now. But none of them, except for Xi Jinping, has had the ambition of ruling the solar system as well.
Well, at a minimum, they understand that near space, if dominated by a power, can determine what happens on the ground on this planet, if not the entire solar system. And this is really part of the problem, Gordon, as you say, is that they have both understood this and integrated it into their plans and capabilities for space in a way that we frankly have not, I think. And as this article makes clear, a very important focus of their program is neutralizing our use of space, particularly the satellites upon which we rely for everything, really. Commerce, for sure, but also our military security. So these are the sorts of things, Gordon, that you have been tracking for quite some time, you've been sounding the alarm about, and that so urgently need to be integrated into our thinking about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to and our development of the kinds of capabilities we must have in order to defend ourselves against this mortal peril from the CCP. We appreciate you visiting with us each week for that purpose, Gordon. Thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do at the Gatestone Institute and through your other outlets, including Newsweek and Twitter. And again, follow Gordon at Gordon G. Chang, as I do. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton, as promised, about, among other things, how do we cut off the cash flow that is enabling this threat from China? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest, one of our regulars here, I'm proud to say, at Secure Freedom Radio, Bill Walton. He is a former master of the universe on Wall Street in the financial sector. He brings those skills to bear on behalf of our nation these days, something one cannot say about all of the people with whom he previously worked. But Bill does that notably through his terrific podcast television program, The Bill Walton Show. He has also been a leader of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member, a very important conservative movement organization. And he is making an outsized impact, I think, on both thought and policies of our conservative movement. And I'm anxious to catch up with him about some of the things we're thinking about at the moment that are very momentous for our country, needless to say. Bill Walton, it's good to have you back. Welcome. You have a new gig that I've just had explained to me, the derivation of it. It's called the Resolute Protector Foundation, and it has something to do with William. Tell us about that.
Well, I wanted to create a 501c3, both to put my webcast in, but also I'm supporting an awful lot of the movement's most interesting activist groups, and including the your group, the China, what do we call our group? The China Center to
Committee on the Present Danger, China.
It's a mouthful. Anyway, it's incredibly useful is what it's doing. So I set up a 501c3 to do that. And it's got some size and heft, but Resolute Protector comes from, as I cast about for a name, William, in Old English translates as Resolute Protector. And it comes from 1066 when William conquered England. And you and I had some fun. We're not quite sure whether it's Anglo-Saxon or Norman. I think it's Anglo-Saxon, but I'm sure one of our listeners will fill us in. Anyway, I always thought
an inspiration, needless to say, Resolute Protecting is what we need a lot of at the moment.
Well, and there is so much we need to protect. I mean, right at the center is freedom, and that sort of seems to be the theme for our battles, both domestically and internationally.
Well, let's talk about foreign for a moment, Bill. I've been talking with our guests, Sam Faddis and Gordon Chang, in the course of this program about Afghanistan. It's top of mind for obvious reasons at the moment. I'd be very interested in your take on what we have witnessed to date and what it says about the quality of American leadership under Joe Biden and his so-called presidency.
Remember the famous photo of the helicopters fleeing Vietnam and the last person out was clambering onto the helicopter? Well, the only thing we're missing, Joe assured us that was never going to happen here. Well, the only thing we're missing is a good photo, because what's happened is we've abandoned the embassy and we've fled to the airport, and we've got a perimeter set up and there are helicopters flying all over Kabul, you know, airlifting people out. I think an alert photographer will probably give us Vietnam withdrawal part two. This is a catastrophe. I mean, which president it can be laid at the feet of, we can debate, but certainly the precipitous way we've withdrawn is the worst possible way. And you look at a map, like Afghanistan, who are its neighbors? Pakistan, Iran, Turkestan, one I can't pronounce, Uzbekistan, India, and our old friends China. And you take us out of the middle of that, then you see what the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have in mind. And it's once again going to become a center for world terrorism activities. Most immediately, they've already gone after some China-related projects. And China sent some of their top people in to start talking with them. Now, ironically, we were protecting China from a lot of this terrorist activities. But us withdrawing, China's now going to deal with it directly.
Let me ask you, if I could, this led to a larger question with Gordon, which we often mull with you and other guests, namely, if China is going to be benefiting from the vacuum that we're creating, whether it's to get mineral resources or other Belt and Road infrastructure-related activities, in furtherance of their efforts to dominate Central Asia and much of the rest of the world, for that matter, under this so-called Belt and Road program. Gordon's view of this is that we ought to be denying them the funds with which they are building out this imperial infrastructure, make the overreach, as he put it, even more intense and more immediate. He has counseled that we ought to stop trading with the Chinese and we ought to stop allowing them to have access to our capital markets. You've been in the business space. You know many of the people who are very active in it. How would you respond to that? And in particular, Bill, I'm anxious to understand whether there is likely to be any kind of internally generated restraint in Wall Street in terms of putting more American investors' money at risk in China, if for no other reason because they've lost a lot of that money in recent months.
Well, let's take it in two pieces. Number one, trading with China, it gets into our real economy, which is where we get goods and services. And the issue there, and I'm sure Gordon understands this, is that our economies are so interconnected. Our supply chains are intertwined. As we've talked before, for example, a lot of our critical drugs come out of China. You know, they subcontract some of that from India, but basically it comes through China. And you look at the presence we've got with all the retail and service companies, like Nike or Walt Disney or a Major League Baseball or National Basketball Association, where they're getting now 20, 30, 40% of the revenue out of China. I don't see quite where the forces are that are going to cause that to end that trade. Now the capital markets are a little different question, because we're talking about monies which can be sourced from all over the world. And you know, China's been drawing from our markets. I was looking back in 2006, they raised about $180 billion in the U.S. capital markets in the bond market anyway. In 2020, it was $5 trillion. And so they're about 20% of the world bond market in terms of raising money. Global equity, they were raising in 2006 about $6-8 billion. Now it's $107 billion, which is almost 15% of the total, roughly $800 billion that was raised last year. There's no doubt, though, that Wall Street probably sees 10-15% of its revenues coming out of and profits coming out of its trade with China, whether it's bonds or equities or advising people in mergers and acquisitions or commissions. I'm a believer in taking action. I just don't see quite how we build the momentum to do that. We've talked before, the three largest money managers, States, Fidelity, State Street, and I think Vanguard's the third one, and they're all in on China, and they're setting up offices there. They own about 20% in aggregate, taken together, they own about 20% of the shares of the S&P 500. We are now really, they see themselves more globalists than they do as Americans. And so I'd love to get on with Gordon to see how we could do that. Certainly, if we could cut off the capital flows, that would be helpful. But the thing to keep in mind is the U.S. market for equities is only about 40% of the world market. And the Chinese bourses or exchanges, Shanghai's, Shenzhen, Hong Kong, and some of the others are quite large. And that's one of the big Chinese companies just raised $3 billion on the Shenzhen exchange, which made it, in effect, a homegrown equity raise.
So this is what some are speculating Xi is up to at the moment in response to efforts to restrict their access to our capital markets that our Committee on the Present Danger of China and our colleague Roger Robinson, you and others have been championing. Xi is now saying, well, we don't need your money. We'll do it all domestically. And they've got help from some of those companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and others, that JP Morgan, to do it with these wholly owned U.S. subsidiaries in China. The question, Bill, is that something that is indicative of perhaps another motivation, namely clearing the decks for war with the United States, to be less dependent upon cash flow that they may not be able to control in the event of hostilities from the United States?
Well, I think we need to, you understand this, Frank. China's been on a war footing for several decades now, but it's been soft power, not hard power. And they've been using their economic muscle to build market share in all these different industries that I just described. They've been working a cultural warfare through Confucius Institutes in the United States. And then I've got this idea that the 90 million members of the Chinese Communist Party are agents of the state, no matter where they are in the world, which means we've got a lot of people in the United States who are really sharing information with the party, and a lot of it technical. A lot of intellectual property theft is still going on in research laboratories. So they've been on a war footing, but not necessarily getting the missiles lined up and the aircraft carriers into the South China Sea pointed at it. But you've got to worry about what they've got in mind with Taiwan. China realizes it's behind the curve on semiconductors, and part of this crackdown that Xi's initiated on these public companies in China. If you look at them, they're really retail. They're frivolous companies in his mind. They're ride sharing, they're games or things like that. He thinks that China tutoring. Well, yeah, tutoring kids to learn things that he may not want them to learn. He wants to redirect capital into the industries that what he sees strategic. Semiconductors, one of them. Now, the problem with that is that semiconductor is a vastly capital-intensive industry. It requires billions and billions of dollars to build a facility. And also, if you're behind the curve in terms of innovation, very hard to break through to be a real player. The easy way to do that would be taking a look at the largest semiconductor manufacturer in the world designer is in Taiwan.
Not just taking a look at it, but taking it over, I think, is your point, right?
Well, you get the whole country, you get the semiconductor facility as well. And, we're not projecting. If you look at Lloyd Austin, you look at Tony Blinken, you look at Joe Biden, the message that you get if you're Xi or you're for the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, and you look at the way they handle Afghanistan, and Blinken before this has been going around an apology tour asking the UN to tell us in what way we have been bad and how we could be better. You're looking at our strategic military defense leadership, and if you care about America, you weep. What was it? The Joint Chief of Staff was saying the biggest problem America faces is white supremacy. Really?
It may be contributing to the rage that a lot of us are feeling at the moment about how our military is being abused.
Well, I'm very upset and angry. I just don't know quite. I would love to get talking with Gordon to see how we would implement something like, you know, cutting off trade with China. I think it may be more strategic to keep them engaged with our economy so they pay the price. Because we're so interconnected. I mean, the risk they have is the risk we have. You enter into conflict, and all of a sudden you're going to lose access to a lot of things that matter for your own supply chains, for your own people, for your own economy. It may be more strategic to stay engaged.
Well, possibly. But I think engaged under terms where they really are calling the shots is probably not healthy, because at some point you will be decoupled from China, and it may be under circumstances that would be very injurious to us all. So I think what Gordon's getting at, and it sounds like a subject for a good three-way conversation here or on the Bill Walton show, but I'd love to entertain that. All right, Bill, let me just finally ask you, I've been picking up rumors that one of the reasons that Wall Street is so resistant to the idea of delisting Chinese companies from our capital markets, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ specifically, is that these exchanges garner very substantial amounts of money by just the listing fees of such companies on Wall Street, such Chinese People's Liberation Army and CCP-controlled companies. You mentioned, you know, that there's not a lot of enthusiasm for cutting off the Chinese. Is this one of the things that's operating as you see it?
Well, I did a little research before we talked, and it looks to me like China is producing about 10%, 12% of the revenue to the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, the other big stock markets, and also the investment banks and commercial banks that are doing business with them. That's about their share of the combined market. I think the market cap in the U.S. is of equities is about 23, 24, 25 trillion. China's got about $3 trillion of that. So what's that, roughly 10%? And so whatever recurring fees they get from that, it's not trivial, but it's not put yourself. If you were a patriot and you cared about doing the right thing, you would say, "Look, I can bite the bullet on that amount. At the margin, it's not gonna be fatal."
Bill Walton, we have to leave it at that for the moment. And so much more to talk about, and we look forward to doing so with you again next week. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay well, and the rest of you will be back with us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.